Government projects, political correctness, and the sense that we're being played. I'm Justin Katz, and this is Last Impressions 24. You know, you have to wonder if one day historians will look back at this period of American history and see it as the period where people were just getting frustrated and fed up with the sense that nothing was working, that they were being played, that the people in power just really didn't care. I mean, there've always been games, but the feeling I get anyway, at least in Rhode Island, especially, and also in the United States, is that it's just becoming, the game is being revealed for what it was. The wheels are off. We're not getting the functionality that used to allow us to accept the games, accept the phony baloney processes and conversations and rules. And now it's just, you know, it's just a power play. And so much of it is in the service of the absurd. And the institutions that we've set up and that owe their existence to their ability to keep the system going are not functioning. And one of the big ones here, obviously, is the news media, I think. They're not serving their function in presenting information to people so that the people can make decisions. Instead, there's the twist, there's the bias, there's the thumb on the scale that pushes it in one direction. Here, I had a post up today on OceanStateCurrent.com that illustrates a small example. I mean, I don't want to overstate it because it's pensions and it can be complicated and so on. And, you know, reporters are under deadline. But Patrick Anderson had an article in the Providence Journal about a really good rate of return on our pension investment last year. So our pension system is designed with the idea that we're going to get back 7.5% return on investment every year. Now that's, I've said and written and spoken and so on a lot about this. I've made videos about it. That's just ridiculous. If you want, a pension has to be a sure thing. You're planning lives around this investment. And when you plan a sure thing investment, you want to plan on 3 to 4%. Maybe that's even high now with inflation being so low recently, but 7.5%. No, that's, you know, aggressive funding. That's what you don't expect to get that back as a baseline. And that's what the pension system wants. But this year, or the last fiscal year for which the reports just came out, we got about 11.6% return. Woohoo! We did it. We beat the target. And Anderson writes that that makes up for last year's loss of 0.27%. Ah, well, there's the thing. Well, no, it doesn't, actually. I mean, it sounds like it does, doesn't it? We only lost 0.27 last year, and this year we made 11.6. So clearly we're in the green. Well, no, because last year when we lost that money, that we didn't get the 7.5% that we needed, which would be reinvested this year and would be making money off it. So if you run the numbers, basically, if you have a year like that, a year of 0.3% loss, call it even zero, you have to have 2 years in a row of 11.6% before you're back to where you expected to be. And this doesn't happen, at least not anymore. Maybe certain decades in the last century it did. Not anymore. And again, partly it's because inflation has been so low. But that was one of them. Another one, actually, and I haven't actually looked into print papers yet, so I don't know if these were printed or just if they're both online today. But the other one, also by Anderson, unfortunately, I'd rather spread the criticism around. But he's talking about the Wickford Junction train station in Rhode Island, which we built to the tune of something like $45 million some years ago. And what a great experience they've had this year, so far this season, because they eliminated the ticket price. It's free. and wow, when you make things free, we saw a 50% increase in ticket, quote unquote, sales from last year. So it went from around, I don't know, lowish mid 220s passengers per day last year to now we're in the 330 to 350 range. So 50% increase, woohoo! And some of those people have now discovered it. and they'll come back next year and keep writing, even though they're going to have to pay. And, you know, hey, free samples, that can be part of sales. I mean, it's not a bad idea if you've got a good product. You offer some freebies out there. You know, even drug dealers know this. We'll be getting it from the government pot dealers pretty soon, I'm sure. But you get some free samples, and people see your product and they like it, and then they come back. And so that could be the thing. You're trying to change habits. So you have this train system with free Wi-Fi, and you know, if you happen to live in the area of Wickford, which not a whole lot of people do, but if you happen to live there and you happen to be going to Providence nearby the train station, well, you know, it makes a lot of convenience. You just ride on up, and the inconvenience of having to actually drive into the city might be enough that they'll want to get off the highway and go to Wickford Junction, finish their trip to Providence from farther distances. So we've got a 50% increase, and there may be some people who keep coming back next year if they actually decide to start charging again. But the thing is, I mean, looking at it as a business proposition, you'd be saying, okay, I'm going to offer some free products, and these people are going to come back enough of them will come back and to grow the business that I'll end up making more money in the future. But this year, half of the year is free, right? So that's half of your revenue, because you're not just giving free samples to the new people, you're giving them to everybody. So half of your revenue out the window. You would have to keep the whole 50% increase next year for a whole year in order to break even on this promotion. And that's not, but none of this is really broken down in the article. It's just how wonderful. Oh, look at these people discovering this beautiful train station, this train ride we now have. And it's an extra 100 people a day because it's free. The thing is, you know, a few years ago when they sold us this plan, you want to guess what they were saying, projecting for daily riders as of the year 2020. So in just a couple of years, they were telling us, when we approved this thing as Rhode Islanders, as voters, taxpayers, that they would have 3,386 daily riders. So even with this huge increase, they're still 1/10 of the number. They have to double their number over and over and over again in the next couple of years, when they're charging for tickets, and they're not even raising money off of parking, as if I recall correctly, which was another way they were planning to pay for this. So this is a loser by any stretch. And there should be, by no means should there be articles talking, putting this in a good, fiscally sound, positive light. The fact that they sold this saying we need $45 million because in 2020, we're going to have 3,386 riders on this thing every day, that should be in every single article about this. Because if you're reading this article and it says, oh, 50% increase, that sounds pretty good. Yeah, but what's the context? The context is you're still getting a fraction of what you were expecting to get. And this is free. So, and I don't think the article even says how much money they're sacrificing for this. It's really not serving the public. And that is what we need more of. We need more. We need a better sense of what's actually happening, what the context actually is, so that we can make better decisions as voters, as taxpayers, homeowners, businesses, and so on. Because otherwise you get this sense that, again, we're just being played. And this ties right into not only the small government little tricks with the news media that they pull, you know, because the government, hey, they've got legions of well-paid media and press people putting out the spin, constantly churning out data and churning out stories for the news reporters, because, you know, reporters' staffs are getting more slim, fewer and fewer paying gigs in journalism in that regard. They can't afford, for example, somebody to cover every town in the state, you know, so they have to sort of, to some extent, just by necessity, take the stories that come to them. And so what does government do? They can just take our money as taxpayers. So they take our money and they spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on people to go out there and spoon feed reporters. Here's an easy story. It's public government, it's government stuff, it's public works, it's whatever, so it's relevant to everybody's lives, And we're going to give you all the numbers. We'll even line up some people. We'll make it showy. You can go sit there and chat with the people and get some good quotes for your story on Wickford's free rides. And it's relatively easy. Comes up with a decent bit of content to sell a newspaper. And government can take our money and pay for that to happen. So you've got this government thing going. But this ties right in with a lot of other progressive strategies. And one I'm most, I don't want to say incensed, but the most that caught my eye in two very specific circumstances in the past week or two, because I missed one of these podcasts, of my reading and listening and viewing as a consumer of news, have to do with political correctness and the sense that we're being played. And so I'm going to tread in some kind of dangerous territory here, I guess, for, you know, a straight white male conservative. But we need to talk about these things. And that's part of the service I'm offering you as just somebody talking into a microphone, is to bring to your attention some significant arguments that we really can't lose sight of as we make decisions in our lives. So the first clip here, Rhode Island Public Radio, and then I'm not going into the budget thing with Speaker Mattiello and Senate President Ruggiero, but it's a chunk of rock that was tossed off in a Rhode Island Public Radio interview with Speaker Nicholas Mattiello, the Democrat from Cranston. And so they're talking about this budget standoff where the House and the Senate are fighting over a relatively meaningless amendment the Senate wanted to make to the budget because it affected the Speaker's big car tax proposal. And this is URI political science professor Maureen Moakley chiming in to challenge Speaker Mattiello on this issue.
Well, I understand that, you know, one of the problems was each of you were trying to protect your institutional prerogatives. As an academic, I have to ask you this question. All the research suggests that of the seven odd thousand legislators, women do a much better job of seeking consensus. So given these data, do you think it would be good if we had more women in leadership positions?
I just love that. I mean, we just start out with the sexist assumptions, the female chauvinist assumptions. Oh, you know, we all know it's just you men being men and guarding turf for no reason other than you're just like the hairy apes that you are fighting for a little bit of turf. So and then we get I'm an academic, and let me make a wild assertion that nobody in the audience is going to be able to challenge on the fly, certainly nobody in this room while we're recording. And I'm going to say that all of the data show something that I want to assert. And then, you know, it goes back to, and so in light of this data that I didn't share, but I did assert exists, don't you think the real problem is that you two are just a couple of dudes and there's no women involved? You know, it'd be great if it were a call-in show right on public radio, but it makes you wonder how many of their listeners actually out there in public radio land are saying to themselves, you know, Maureen, I wonder if that's actually true. And I did wonder that. So I did some poking around, and I'm not claiming to have spent a week deep in the weeds of academic research, which presumably this professor from URI would have done, but a very quick read of some relatively high profile and respectable publications suggests that she's not quite characterizing the body of research accurately. So just real quick, this is one from a paragraph from The Atlantic, an article last August by Andrew McGill. And I know it's suspect because he's a dude, right? He's a guy, another hairy ape. So who knows what he's changing in this article. But it seemed to give this consensus of a lot of what I read. So this quick paragraph from Andrew McGill in an article, again, the links to all this stuff, articles I cite, and audio will be on the post for this podcast on OceanStateCurrent.com. But here's Andrew McGill. Are women more willing to compromise? It's a question that defies a simple answer, with studies that flip back and forth. Women are more cooperative. Wait, they're not. On what seems like an annual basis. The most recent entry, released earlier this month, is a National Bureau of Economic Research working paper that focused on how gender affects bipartisanship. It concluded that women are indeed more likely to cooperate across party lines, but only if they're Republican, and particularly if they're working on a bill that focuses on health, education, or social welfare. In short, collaboration tends to happen only under very specific circumstances. End quote. So, this study found that women's willingness to compromise may be because they're more liberal within their parties. So, Republican women are willing to compromise not because they're women, and that makes them more saintly, but because they're closer to the line of compromise to begin with, right? So that's not something you can generically assert. So according to this data, since it's only Republican women who are more likely to compromise, the bringing a woman into leadership as a Democrat woman at the table right now with these other two Democrats who can't quite make their budget compromise work isn't going to do any good. What we need is, you know, House Minority Leader Patricia Morgan, right? The conservative to be in there. Maybe that'll do it. I tend to doubt it because, as the study also said, this compromise only works when you're specifically talking about health, education, or social welfare. This is a big budget with a lot of stuff in it, so it might not apply here. That would be, you know, just one of the studies, and contrary to the professor's assertion that all the studies are like this. Another article I found that was interesting is a March article on Vox, which is left wing. And this one is credible because it's by a woman. It's by Sarah Cliff, who's clearly on the side of getting women more power in government. But she writes, women legislators are more likely to introduce legislation that specifically benefits women. So, in other words, they act quite a bit like a special interest, which, you know, as a minority of legislators isn't unexpected. But we also can't ignore the fact that women have been trained to behave this way. I mean, they've been the social pressures for them to do that. And if you look at politics and the national limelight, you only get when you're in one of these special interest groups or one of these identity politics categories, you only get the privileges if you happen to also be progressive. You know, if you're Sarah Palin, you get no benefit of the doubt for being a woman. In fact, you'll probably be attacked all the more. So if you take the sex part out of it, Moakley's claim here is that women are better able to work out differences. But a quick bit of research suggests that that may be because they are more politically homogeneous and they act more like a special interest. So they'll compromise because they bring forward issues that they care about. They're more focused on a particular issue, so they'll compromise in order to get that through. And they're also, if they're Republican, they're more liberal than other Republicans, so they're more likely to compromise with Democrats because they agree with them more. That's not really a profile of compromisers when you make that, even at parity, but certainly dominant. So if you take people with narrow special interests who compromise mainly because they already agree with the other people and make them the majority, that doesn't make we would have to test this out scientifically, you know, as the academics would say. But you wouldn't necessarily expect that group, suddenly given more power, to be less concerned about their own interests than they were before. You see what I'm saying? I mean, we can see this playing out in our politics. We can see how when you take this minority group, in a sense of not the governing majority, the typical white male image, and you give them power, they do not maintain their saintliness. They do exactly what people in power do, and that's abuse, but leverage their power. So even if we put that whole thing aside for the sake of argument, you know, the way folks who share Moakley's view put it, you think that, you know, women's ability to compromise is this inherent thing. But even there, I mean, it could simply be context. I mean, maybe, I mean, whether it's because of some kind of, you know, political bias or institutional bias, or even if it's just because women choose to do other things, all else equal, this tendency, this likelihood that women will do other things than become politicians, that makes them, you know, kind of self-selective, right? Those who run will have a different set of interests and abilities than the average woman. And when you get a broader group of men, their interests and abilities will be broader by that. So you're selecting for women who are going to be doing a particular legislation a particular way. And if the studies find that they're more effective at moving legislation that they care about, which they do, of course, that could also be that because of identity politics, groups of legislators, when they put forward policies, like to put women and minorities at the front, other minorities at the front of the line, at the front of the bill, in front of the camera, because it's harder to say no to them in our current political context. So that may be why they're more effective. But even if they are more effective, it might just be because fewer the women who actually do make that decision, for whatever reason, whether it's bias or personal preference, on average among women, the threshold to become a politician is higher. So you'll get a more effective politician if we accept that. but I had to, there were a couple things I had to chuckle at when Mattiello responded. The first one, I'll take the safer one first. Actually, I'll have a sip of water first. I could edit that out, but we're going for realism here, right? So the safer one is Mattiello's response is, well, you know, I'm one who believes that women are uniquely creative. They're half the population, give or take, right? Uniquely? I mean, are they all half the population is uniquely creative from the other half? I mean, what are you saying? Each one of them is uniquely creative in their own way, in a flat, like all snowflakes or flowers are different, as opposed to men who, you know, we're just a bunch of oafs and we're all very similar. We're not uniquely creative at all. And then, you know, it's kind of funny how you're only allowed to say things like that. You know, the genders are different. One is better than the other. If you say it about women, men, you can't say men are particularly well suited to anything. You know, that's just not allowed anymore. I really don't want to highlight this, but it's just too. I find it too funny. And then Mattiello goes and you know, if Rhode Island were a big enough audience to generate a lot of stand-up comics, I recommend them to take a listen to this segment of Rhode Island Public Radio. But because then Mattiello says, you know, women are uniquely creative. I love women, and I will take women in any position. I wonder if he, as soon as he said that, he thought, let me move on. I hope nobody caught that. And I just thought it was funny. We have to laugh, right? Now, the other instance I wanted to get into was Malcolm Gladwell. And he has a really excellent podcast series. It's in season 2 now of Revisionist History. And it purports to be something where he takes a look at something misunderstood in history, in the news, and tries to shed a different light on it. Sometimes he drifts off on that and goes on his own pet things, but hey, I can't blame him, and they're still interesting. And he does prove to be relatively relatively reasonable and willing to listen to other sides for somebody who's obviously liberal or progressive. And one recent episode was about the Birmingham civil rights marches, and there's a statue there called Foot Soldier, which the marchers were called, and it's of a famous picture that sort of changed the course of civil rights history, of a police officer, a white police officer, allowing his dog to bite a young boy, black protester, a foot soldier. And so Gladwell goes through this whole, and so the picture, the Gladwell goes through the whole history of it. He tracks down the participants, or at least audio of them talking, and he pieces it together, and he points out that the picture, the photograph, was actually much different than the statue that's now there commemorating this event. In a real circumstance, the cops are just there in this difficult situation trying to keep peace between protesters and people just who spectators and anybody else who might be there yelling at the protesters or whatever. The cops do, I mean, the same cops generally were forcing schools to let black students attend. So the cops are just doing their job. And what happened was this black kid who was cut in school runs behind the barrier, and the dog, before the cop can do anything, jumps up and bites at him. And the cop, if you look at the picture, is trying to restrain the dog or keep him away from the boy. And the boy is taller than the cop. And it's a much more, let's say, ideologically ambiguous photograph. But it became the symbol of white racism, and it changed the course of history, arguably. It was the catalyst that a lot of people were waiting for. The statue, on the other hand, the sculptor admits to Gladwell, I shrunk the boy, made him a boy. The actual boy in the photo complains in an interview that the sculptor made him look African, more black than he actually is. So he made the dog look worse. The cop is bigger, more stern looking, almost like he's pushing the boy rather than trying to pull him back from the dog, and essentially made up a new narrative from this photograph. And now, keep in mind, as Gladwell's been going through this history of how he came to all these details, he talks to the widow of the cop, and they were getting death threats. I mean, this was a very disturbing thing for this guy who was just trying to do his job, but he happened to be in the wrong place and have a photographer, a news reporter, photographer, I think, get a shot of him in this moment in time, and to tell a completely different story than the reality. And so after all this, laying this out for 20-something minutes, Gladwell, the relatively reasonable liberal, concludes this.
That's what history is. Each side writes their own story, and the winner's story is the one we call the truth. You don't think white people told their share of whoppers over the years in the South? You don't think that there's a statue in a southern town somewhere of a champion of the Confederacy that makes a hero of someone who is actually a villain? White people got to do that in the South for centuries. Foot soldier is just what happens when the people on the bottom finally get the power to tell the story their way. It was a long time coming.
Now, there's a certain irony to this. One of the things the sculptor changed in the image to make the statue more dramatic and more symbolic than the photograph was, naturally, was to put like blind person glasses on the cop because he's blind, acting out of racism. He doesn't see a person there. He just sees a N-word. And that seems to me what Malcolm Gladwell's doing right there, isn't it? I mean, he's saying white people got to write history in the South for centuries. So it's about time that this particular white person has the tables turned against him and gets death threats. It's about time. That's disturbing. And it goes to show, back to the previous topic, that the minorities taking over doesn't take over saints. You get people at the top who are going to abuse their power, and they'll leverage their minority status to do that. But even in broader strokes, people will do what people do. And if that means unfairly portraying people who are still alive, by the way, not, you know, these old Civil War statues of people who are dead, but people who are still alive, if you become the villain in this moment, you know, that's just, hey, it's about time. It's about time you got yours, because your people have done this to their people. You know, you're not individuals. You're representative of a people, and therefore you deserve this suffering and or this these death threats. You deserve this or that, or you deserve to be distrusted, or you deserve to have your opportunities curtailed to make up for other opportunities in the past, whether or not, because of your skin color, whether or not your ancestors were part of that or not, you have to be curtailed. And, you know, and that's, I just find this constantly disappointing, especially in somebody like Gladwell, who I've found, as I said, although often incorrect, I believe, still to be, you know, open to other sides. And I almost think he doesn't even believe the about time thing. I think in a literary sense, it was just a good way to come to a conclusion and make a statement about the whole thing rather than just say, hey, it's much more complicated than you think, right? I mean, he does go on to say, well, then, you know, but when you're looking at the statue, realize that, you know, keep in mind that it wasn't, you know, these people weren't actually like that. But it's about time. I mean, that's the big conclusion. It's dramatic. And so I wonder if he even necessarily meant it to be a definitive expression of his point of view. But wouldn't it be so much healthier if the conclusion were, let's correct this unfairness. Let's take this opportunity with our ability to go back in time and listen to audio, and look at cameras, talk to people, communicate over the entire globe instantly. Let's take this opportunity to correct this unfairness and see each other on an equal footing and say, that was too far, this is too far. And instead, we're just setting up the next injustice and the next conflict. I mean, it's too cliche, so I almost don't want to say it, but this is what got you Trump, right? If you don't like what Trump's doing, you know, go ahead and keep doing this. Keep doubling down on this about time attitude, and you're going to get worse. You're going to get a conflict. You're going to get the thing flipping. You know, the devil doesn't care which side he takes in human conflicts. This year, he'll be the peacemaker if that's going to sow disruption. Next year, he'll be the warmonger if that's going to sow destruction. He'll support the white supremacists when that causes people to pull away from God, and he'll support the Black Lives Matter fist in the air resistance when that's what will bring people to corruption. All that talk about how the cop in the statue is blind to the humanity of the boy, it's just the same as this treatment of the cop, and it's very disappointing. And I think we need to be a little bit more vociferous about insisting on fairness and pointing out to people who probably want to be fair that they're not being fair, pointing out to people who probably want to give people a balanced understanding of a current event that they're, you know, you're really not. I mean, I do this terribly. I think I'm too aggressive. Or, you know, there's a question, a topic for another time. And is it because I'm too aggressive, or is it because I'm just pointing out things that are inherently uncomfortable to certain people? I don't know. But we need to find this a way to do this, because otherwise we're just going to keep going in these cycles, and it's not going to work out well. Because, as I said at the beginning, you know, people don't like to be played, and history will prove it out one way or another, whoever writes it.